Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 154. I'm recording it on Saturday, August 1st, 2009. The P10 level today is 16. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of this selection is Comic Plotting. The title of the podcast is Low Stock Prices Are Better Than High Stock Prices. You're sitting around your apartment watching a movie, say, and an angel comes down from heaven. And the angel explains a little bit about her life, and she says, you know, it's a good deal up in heaven. Meals are very good. There's no sickness. No sickness at all. No disco. No disco to worry about. But it's a hard job. People don't realize. People down here, they think, oh, to be an angel, but it's a hard job. God gives us these decisions to make. We have to make decisions about how things are going to go down here on planet Earth, and we have to factor in a lot of things. For example, one of my friends is the angel that determines whether the Yankees or the Red Sox will win the pennant. And you've got to look at the Yankees sometimes get a little too full of themselves, and they need to be, you know, put in their place, punished a little bit, and you got to take something away from the Yankees. But the Red Sox fans, they, you know, a lot of them, with a little more suffering here on Earth, they could make it into heaven, but they're sort of on the borderline, so we don't want to give them too many pennants. They need their suffering, those Boston fans. And another one of my friends is in charge of the dating situation, and some young man will ask a young lady to dance, and the angel has to decide. And the angel says, well, this fellow, he's had a hard road, and maybe we should give him a break, but she's way out of his class, and if we give him a break tonight, he's just going to get his hopes up. The poor fellow. He's going to get crushed later on, so maybe it's better just to deliver the medicine fast and quick. And there's an angel in charge of the weather, and you have all these people saying, oh, we need rain. Our town is low on water. We're trying to conserve water. We need a rain. And then there's some nice family planning a picnic, and they're saying, please, all the children are praying, please don't let it rain today. God, please don't let it rain. And the angel has to make the call, because these are not the sort of calls that go directly to God. These are, what's the word? When you hire an assistant, delegate. These are delegated. And that's where I come in. And I'm an angel in charge of the Dow Jones average. I'm the Dow Jones average angel. And you're 40 years old. Not the angel, the person. You. You're 40 years old, and you've saved $100,000. You're pretty happy with that. You've got $100,000 in your stock account, retirement account. And the Dow today is at 9,000. And the angel says, all right, we've been talking this over, the other angels. I have assistant angels. And we've decided that Tomorrow is going to be a volatile day in the stock market. Now, you're not going to be able to trade on this information. Please understand. If you try, you'll be knocked down, knocked off your horse. So, don't try to trade this. But I'm letting you know, tomorrow's going to be a volatile day. The stock price is going to change 1,000 points. But we have a little thing going on in heaven lately. There's an innovation, this game show. There was this game show where you could call your friends if you didn't know the answer to the question. What was it? The 64th? I forget what it was. And, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Wasn't that it? And, God thought that was great. That was a great idea. Get the community working together. And so he's given us this option of coming down to Earth and asking people involved what they would do. And so we know that the Dow is going to change 1,000 points tomorrow. We've already decided that. I'm not asking for your input. But we have a little back and forth about should it go up 1,000 points or should it go down 1,000 points. And we'd like your input. We're going to let you make the call. If you say up 1,000, Dow's going to go up 1,000 points tomorrow. If you say down 1,000, Dow's going to go down 1,000 points tomorrow. You may think it over. You have 5 minutes. So what will it... 5 minutes, I'll shut up and let you think. What would you say? Up 1,000 points to 10,000. Now you think it over. You take out a pad of paper and you round things off because you're not real good with numbers. And you say, well, I've got 100,000 in stocks, and a move from 9,000 to 10,000, that's roughly 10%. I mean, you know, let's not be picky. So, okay, 100,000 plus 10% gives me 110,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's really 109, I guess, but somewhere around there. On the other hand, a drop of 10 of 1,000 points is going to be a loss of about 10%. That means instead of gaining $10,000, I lose $10,000. So the choice the angel's giving me, it's a difference of $20,000. I'm either going to lose $10,000 tomorrow or I'm going to gain $10,000 tomorrow. This is like easy peasy. I mean, what, are you kidding me? I want the Dow to go up to 10,000. I don't need 5 minutes to make this call. Angel, I know the answer to this one. The idea of this podcast is don't answer the angel too quickly. Use your whole 5 minutes. Call one of your friends, just like the angel did. Call Rob Bennett, see what he thinks. Your friend Rob Bennett is going to tell you, your first instinct is wrong. You want the angel to lower the Dow by 1,000 points. And if you come to understand why, I believe you will be a rational investor for the rest of your life. You will no longer be a passive investor. This goes to the heart of it. I'm always talking about the stock selling industry. You hear me say that all the time. The reason I say that is because passive investing is the worst investing strategy ever concocted by the human mind. For the investor, it's arguably a good thing for the stock selling industry, although I have my doubts about even that, but it's arguably good for the stock selling industry. But it's a disaster for the middle class investor. And I say this often, but my job is to persuade, and there's a mental block here. There are people who have a hard time accepting it. And I have to think why. And what I come to is that It all has to do, it's not an intellectual problem. There's no lack of intellect in the middle, in the community of middle class investors. That's not it. Not at all. See, zero evidence of that. It's not an intellect problem. It's a, you could call it a bias. It's a bias. I often say it's an emotional problem. We have an emotional filter that we apply to all data points that come in. And once you are a passive investor, you get locked into a certain way of thinking. And it doesn't matter how strong the case is that this is a disaster, you can't let it in. And I'm always searching, what is the key? What words do I have to say to help people understand that they've locked themselves into a bad investing strategy? That valuation-informed indexing allows you to retire 5 years sooner than passive indexing. Why would you want to delay your retirement by 5 years? For what purpose? And it's because most of us, it's because we believe in passive investing. But the reason we believe in passive investing, I'm trying to think, why is it? Why is it we're so stuck on this? And a big part of it is we see ourselves as being part of the stock selling industry. So I want to explain. I want to explore this a little bit. If you sell, a book, for $20, there's a cost of manufacturing the book. Let's just say that all your cost. Yeah, there's a cost. You got to manufacture the book, but you also have to pay the author royalties. You have to have transport. You have to ship it. There's all sorts of costs involved. There's insurance. There's taxes. There's all kinds of things. Say that the cost comes to $10. If you sell it for $20, you make a $10 profit. You sell it for $15, you make a $5 profit. You sell it for $25, you make a $15 profit. The seller of this item wants the price to be as high as possible. The buyer, this is very simple, obviously, but it's important. I have to set the groundwork for the rest of this to make sense. The buyer wants the price to be as low as possible. So the buyer doesn't want to pay 20. He'd like to pay 15. If be better if he could pay 10. Be better yet if he could pay 5. There's no benefit in the buyer of a book paying a high price. There's no benefit in the seller of a book paying a low price. Well, it's like that for the stock selling industry when it comes to stocks, because people in the stock selling industry make money when money changes hands. So the more money changes hands, the more money they make. They make money on commissions, basically, or transaction cost. Index funds have lower transaction cost. I think that's a good thing, but there's still money being made. By the Vanguard, I think technically it is a nonprofit, but I can't quite say Vanguard isn't a nonprofit organization because I think it is. But I think it's legally set up that way. That's my understanding. I'm not sure. I think so. But the people that worked at Vanguard are paid salaries. Some of them are paid very big salaries. So there's still money coming in. And all the other companies, many of them, of course, are for-profit entities, and there's money coming in. There's more money coming in if more transactions are made, and there's more money coming in if the transactions are made at higher prices. So the stock selling industry wants people buying stocks at all times. The stock selling industry wants people buying stocks at all times, just as any industry would. The car selling industry wants you to buy a new car every 3 years. The book buying industry wants you to buy a new book every month. Everybody that sells a product wants you to buy their product. This is just perfectly natural and perfectly understandable and perfectly good. The thing that's unique about stocks is that this, I don't know if you want to call it tension. There's a healthy tension between the buyer and the seller in all other industries. The buyer wants a low price. The seller wants a high price. This came up. Drip Guy is one of the goons at Goon Central, and he's brought this up several times, three or four times, and it's a good point. I congratulate Drip Guy for this point. He talked about the car industry, and he's, you know, because we were talking about stocks and what overvaluation means, and he talked about the car industry, and he basically said, there is an efficient market in the car industry. I don't think it's perfectly efficient, but efficiency is a very important reality. If you've ever gone in and tried to buy a used car, I did this when we bought our Volvo some years ago now, I guess 9 years ago, and I didn't spend a lot of time researching, but I spent some time, and what you find is there are some prices are better than others. In other words, one dealer, you'll get a better deal. There's no question that if you spend some time looking, you can get a better deal. But in general, the prices that are charged make sense. I wouldn't say they're perfectly efficient, but I'd say they make sense. And if you go to a dealer and you see a much lower price, there's usually a reason. Something wrong with that car. And they haven't been able to get rid of it. And they're lowering the price to try to get rid of it. Again, not perfect efficiency. There really are great deals out there. But you've got to be pretty sharp to find them. Because if you don't know what you're looking for, you might look at something and think it's a great deal and it's really a bad deal. But if you don't, the beauty of the efficiency in the car market, which is not perfect, is that if you don't do any research at all, you might get burned, but you probably won't get burned all that much because all the other players in the market are forcing prices to be at least in the right neighborhood. Basically, they charge a price that's marked up beyond what it should be, and if you're smart enough, you can talk them down if you know the right things to say, if you've done your homework, and if you haven't, you're going to end up paying a penalty for not having done your research. But the penalty, I don't know what it is. I can't say if it... I don't know, I'm tempted to say 20%, but there's a definite penalty. But it's not 100%. It's not a huge number. That's neat. That's how markets are supposed to work. That's the beauty of markets. That it doesn't work that way in the stock area. And the reason this is the whole problem. This is why we've had the stock crash. This is why we have this economic crisis. It doesn't work. This is why the passive investing model is upside down. The passive investing model assumes that the stock market is like other markets, and it is not. The reason it's not like other markets is you don't have the sellers and the buyers don't see themselves as being on opposite sides. The stock selling industry wants to sell stocks. So when they give us advice on how to invest, it's slanted. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I don't think they meet behind closed doors and say, you know, let's screw the middle class. But I do think they have heavy financial pressures to play up the positives of stocks. And stocks have a lot of positives. So, you know, to some extent, that's good. Just as cars have a lot of positives and books. Is it a bad thing when they try to, you know, sell a car and they point out, hey, it's got air conditioning, it's got airbags, whatever it is. It's not a bad thing. If they didn't sell those things, if they didn't market those things, we wouldn't have airbags. Nobody would have innovated. So it's good that they do this. It's not a bad thing. The trouble in the stock selling industry is there's nobody on the other side pulling the price down. There's nobody arguing. You know, when you're in there negotiating for a car, the dealer's telling you, this is the greatest car in the world, you know, it's got a great engine, it's got all these features, it's gonna last forever. He's pumping it up. And you're saying, well, yeah, it's a nice enough car. I like this car, but it's got a lot of miles on it, friend. And I don't think I'd want to pay this amount of money for a car with that many miles. I mean, I could get a new car, not that much more than this one. I mean, this is a price. It's a good car, but that price is a little high. That's the way it's supposed to work. That's the way markets work. And in the stock field, you've got the experts, the people from the stock selling industry coming out saying, stocks for the long run, buy and hold, timing never works. And then you've got the people buying the stock saying the same thing. They're just repeating it back. There's no opposing interest. And without that opposing interest, the market doesn't work. It doesn't function. Now, somebody's going to say, technically, it's not the stock selling industry that's selling the stock. The transaction is between two investors. You know, the stock selling industry is sort of a go-between. You have to go through somewhere there has to be a broker involved, you know. But it's really two people that own the stocks, or two entities. And that's, of course, accurate. But I call it the stock selling industry because the industry benefits from sales. The industry wants to encourage sales. They don't really favor either party of the transaction. They like sales. So they want people to always buy stocks. And in terms of the two people in the transaction, they should be at odds. One should be saying stocks are good, and one should be saying stocks are bad, but they're not. When a bull market is going on, just about it, the whole world is, the only people saying stocks are bad are people that are shorting the market. There's this tiny group that we call bears that are saying stocks are bad, but 90% of the world is saying stocks are great. The newspapers are saying they're great, and magazines and websites, they're all saying stocks are great. So even the person selling the stock, he probably holds other stocks, and he still likes stocks, and he still wants stock prices to go up, but he's selling for whatever reason. Maybe he needs some money to cash in, or maybe he just, you know, he's a little scared or something. Something's going on to make him sell, but probably if you interviewed him, you'd find out he really likes high stock prices. He thinks it's good. He's not trying to... He's not really anti-stock. He's selling, but he's not really anti-stock. And so the result is, what we need to get accurate information is, we need people from both sides arguing the case as strongly as they can, both the pro-stock side and the anti-stock side, and then we could listen to the arguments back and forth and decide for ourselves who makes the better case. But when everybody contributing to the debate is on one side, or 90% are on one side, you're getting a greatly slanted story. And that's how we get ourselves into trouble. So, let's return to our angel, the mental exercise with the angel from heaven that asks you, do you want stock prices to go up 1,000 points tomorrow or go down 1,000 points tomorrow? And you calculate it and you say, I think I want them to go up because that means I gain $10,000 in my portfolio rather than lose $10,000, and that's a $20,000 differential. And how can earning $20,000 be a bad thing? It's a bad thing. The title of the podcast is Low Stock Prices Are Better Than High Stock Prices. It's a bad thing for you to earn that $20,000 tomorrow. Now, the key to all of this, key to everything I say on every podcast is that if the Dow goes up 1,000 points tomorrow, it's true that you'll be 20,000 ahead. You'll gain 10,000 instead of losing 10,000. That's a positive. However, that $10,000 gain comes at a cost. You have to understand the cost. If you understand the cost, you understand why passive investing can never work in the real world for the long-term investor. The reality is, stock prices are not generated by a random number generator in the sky. They are not. Stock prices in the long term reflect economic realities. The economic realities in the United States, the growth in the U.S. economy, for a long, long time, going back many, many, many years, growth in the United States, productivity, the U.S. economy has been strong enough to finance an average increase in stock prices of 6.5% real per year. That's 6.5% plus inflation. So if you had a year with 3% inflation, an increase in stock prices of 9.5% would be appropriate. Anything more than that would be inappropriate. Anything less than that would be inappropriate. The right number is 6.5 real. So, obviously, if stocks go up 1,000 points tomorrow, that affects whether at the end of this year, the gain for the year is going to be 6.5 or not. If they go up 1,000 points, the odds are good that at the end of the year, stocks are going to have gone up more than 6.5 real. And there are consequences to that. If for the year, stock prices go up more than 6.5, what happens? What happens is they have to come down in following years enough to bring the average annual gain back down to 6.5 real. Okay? If we have a year where the gain is more than 6.5 real, there has to be a year in the future where prices come down enough to bring the average annual return back down to 6.5 real. The economic realities require this. This is not speculation. There's a little speculation because the 6.5 number isn't locked in stone. Productivity could change so that the average return would be 7% or 6%. It could change. But it's not likely going to change all that much. We have a mature economy. It's not likely to change a whole lot. So, any gain in stock prices causes a loss later on. And any loss, it works the other way. Any loss causes a gain later on. There's no exception to this rule. Every time stock prices go up, the expected long-term return goes down. And every time stock prices go down, the expected long-term return goes up. So, is the angel doing you a favor to hand you $10,000? Not really. Now, if you sell the day after tomorrow, then yes, then you cash out and you've got your $10,000. That's the conventional analysis is fine. But if you're like most of us, you're not going to sell. Where are you going to invest your retirement money if you sell? What are you going to do? Invest in money markets the rest of your life? If you're like most of us, you're going to stay in stocks. So you get the benefit of the 1,000-point increase. You get the benefit of the $10,000 gain. But the other side, this is like accounting, there's two sides to the transaction. Every transaction has a plus and a minus. All you've done is subtract 1,000 points of gain that you would have experienced at a later time. It didn't help you at all. Didn't help you at all. If you're going to hold stocks. In other words, the economic realities stocks are going to go up 1,000 points over time. You know, they're now at 9,000. They're going to go up to 10,000. It's not that they're never going to get there. They're going to get there whether the angel does it or not. The difference is the angel speeded up the process. The angel made it happen in one day when it otherwise might have been stretched out over a month or a year or 2 years or whatever. I don't know. Is that a good thing? Did the angel do you a favor by speeding it up? I say no. Why? Because the $100,000 you have in stocks today is not the only money you're ever going to put into stocks. You have, you know, if you have a 401k, you're buying stocks, whatever, every 2 weeks when you get paid. Well, if you buy stocks every 2 weeks, the price you pay for the stocks you buy is determined by what they're selling for at the time you make the purchase. You want that price to be low, not high. You want that price to be low, not high. So by the angel speeding up the price increase, the angel has hurt you. You didn't get any additional gains that you weren't going to get anyway. All you're going to get is the gains justified by the economic realities. Not a penny more or a penny less if you're a long-term stockholder. That's set. And there's nothing you can do about it, or, I mean, the angel theoretically could do something about it, but under our hypothetical, the angel doesn't have those powers. So you're going to get the 1,000 increase in time. The only question that the angel decides is when. Do you get it in one day, or do you have to wait a month or a year or 2 years or 3 years? And you have elected to speed it up. You told the angel, your first reaction was, yeah, give me now, give me now, give me now. I want, I want, I want. And what that means is I want to pay higher prices for all the stocks I buy. My next paycheck and the paycheck after that and the paycheck after that and the paycheck after that. Instead of buying those stocks at a relatively low price, you will be buying them at a relatively high price. And what do you think that does to your chances of achieving a decent middle-class retirement in a reasonable amount of time? It hurts them. By speeding up the price increase, you hurt yourself. What's the ideal for a middle-class investor? The ideal for a middle-class investor, the ideal for a middle-class investor is if we could have no stock price gains for a long, long time, just have it stay at 9,000, and then the year before you're ready to retire, have it go up to whatever, 50,000 all at once. Then you'd be buying stocks at low prices your whole life, but you'd still have enough money to retire. In other words, have the economic realities kick in only when you need the money. Only when you need the money. Now, William Bernstein addressed this point, not exactly the same point, but a related point, in his book, The Four Pillars of Investing, on page 61. It's a chapter two of this book is wonderful. It's my favorite chapter of any investing book. So I'm going to read the section where he discusses this. And I find this whole thing fascinating, this whole question of when is the best time for gains in stock prices to occur from the investor standpoint. Because I think if investors could appreciate what's good for them, we would no longer have bull markets. And if we no longer had bull markets, we would no longer have bear markets. If we no longer had bear markets, we would no longer have these horrible economic crises. We have to train ourselves not to want bull markets. And the only way to do that is to understand why bull markets are a bad thing for us. So I'm very interested in this idea of demonstrating why price increases are a bad thing for the middle-class investor. So Let me see if I can find where to start here. He says, this is on page 61. The most sustainable way to get high stock returns is to have a dramatic fall in stock prices. Isn't that a funny sentence? Famed money manager Charles Ellis likes to tease his friends with a clever riddle. And this is a clever riddle. He asks them which market scenario they would rather see as long-term investors. Stocks rising dramatically and then staying permanently at that high level, or falling dramatically and staying permanently at that low level. Which sounds better to you? That's me speaking. Back to Bernstein. The correct answer is the latter, since with permanently low prices, you will benefit from permanently high dividends. As the old English ditty says, milk from the cows, eggs from the hens, a stock by God for its dividends. After several decades, the fact that you are reinvesting income at a much higher dividend rate will more than make up the damage from the original price fall. To benefit from this effect, you have to be investing for long enough, typically more than 30 to 50 years. Then he does a chart where he looks at dividend yield, dividend growth, and total return. And he looks at what happens over the long term if you have no fall in prices, a 50% fall or an 80% fall. And with no fall, the gain is 6.4. With 50% fall, the gain is 7.8. With an 80% fall, the gain is 12%. He says, after an 80% fall in prices, the higher long-term return eventually compensates for the initial devastation. Even better than having a long time horizon in this situation is having the wherewithal to periodically invest sums regularly at such low levels. This dramatically shortens the break-even point, and most of us do, of course, invest small amounts at regular intervals. So that break-even point is much, much lower, much quicker. The implications of the last scenario are profound. What this says is that a young person saving for retirement should get down on his knees and pray for a market crash so that he can purchase his nest egg at fire sale prices. For the young investor, prolonged high stock prices are manifestly a great misfortune, as he will be buying high for many years to invest for retirement. Alternatively, the best scenario for a retiree living off of savings is a bull market early in retirement. For the retiree, the worst-case scenario is a bear market in the first few years of retirement, which would result in a very rapid depletion of his savings from the combination of capital losses and withdrawals necessary for living expenses. So, what Bernstein is saying is, the young person wants a crash, the young investor, because then the young investor can buy stocks at low prices for many, many years and do well. When you buy at low prices, you obviously do well. But he says to the retiree, that's not true, because the retiree will get in trouble if prices fall. Now, there's a lot of truth in that. That's certainly true. If you look at the in our studies of safe withdrawal rates, we found that the thing that kills a retirement is big price drops in the first 10 years of retirement. Every retirement failure we found resulted from a big price drop in the first 10 years. So what he's saying is generally true, although there are some subtleties to it that make it a little less true, and perhaps I'll try to work through some of those in the time remaining here. But the basic point I want to make is you have to ask yourself, where do stock prices come from? I often point out how I say John Bogle got me on the path I am on today. You know, it's an irony, because John Bogle is Mr. Passive Investing. I argue that passive investing is the worst idea in the history of personal finance. And yet I learned this by reading John Bogle's book. And the wonderful part of John Bogle's book, there are a lot of good parts to it, but the part I found most wonderful is he explained where stock returns come from. And I don't think most investors understand this. I think many people are under the impression that stock returns come from some sort of random number generator in the sky. It's like nobody knows what the stock return's going to be. And, you know, it's like pulling a lottery ticket. They just shake the dice around and something comes out. And that's not how it works. That's just not how it works. If that were how it worked, stock investing would be gambling, plain and simple. If that were how it worked, it would be possible to have bad stock returns 30 years in a row. It would be possible for stocks to return zero. And I think there's this fellow, Zvi Bodhi. I did a podcast on him not too long ago. He did a book called Worry-Free Investing. My impression is that that's how he thinks stock investing works. I don't think that. But his idea, how I read it, was that the reason he didn't like stocks as a long-term investment class is that he believes in this idea that the passive model pushes that stock returns are just random events. And he said, yes, there might have been good random events in prior history, but there's nothing to say all the numbers can't come up bad for the next 30 years, in which case the middle-class investor will be wiped out if he invests in stocks. So he's basically arguing that because that's a possibility, the risk is just too great, and you need to go with something like TIPS. That's sort of the extreme. I view it as two extremes. The passive investing is one extreme. Bodhi's idea is another extreme, and I'm in the middle. But I don't think stock prices are random events. I don't think it's possible to have 30 years of bad stock returns in a row. Because I believe stock returns reflect economic realities. The only way you could have 30 years of bad returns would be have 30 years of bad economic realities. And, you know, if that happens, of course. But that's never happened in the U.S. economy. If you assume we're going to have 30 years of bad returns, of course, you don't want to be in stocks. But the passive investors don't assume that. They clearly, they're very strange. They believe in contradictory things. Passives believe that, on the one hand, they believe stock returns are random. Nobody can predict them. This is why they say timing doesn't work. You can't have any idea what the market's going to do. And on the other hand, they say invest in stocks because stocks always give good returns. But you can't have it both ways. If it's totally random, then what Bodhi is saying is true. Stocks could give totally bad returns forever and ever and ever. But if stock returns reflect economic realities, which is what Bogle really teaches if you read his books and his speeches, then stock returns are predictable because the economy is predictable. It's not predictable in a week or a month or a year. Nobody knows how the economy is going to do this year. But it sure is shooting as predictable long term. And so are stock returns because the two are connected. The one follows from the other. This is why long-term stock returns are predictable. This is why I say long-term timing works and short-term timing doesn't. So, if long-term timing works, if long-term stock prices are predictable, if stock prices are not, do not come from a random number generator in the sky, then you know in advance where the Dow or the S&P is going to be in the long term. You don't know precisely, but you know the neighborhood. You have a general neighborhood number. And something follows from that. That if there's ever a variance above that number or below that number, you know that the probabilities of getting the average return drop. So, if all that's true, I could tell you today, this 40-year-old, you could mathematically do an exercise where you go out 25 years and you say at age 65, the stock market's going to be X. I have no idea what the number is, but it could be done mathematically. If it's 9,000 today, you just have to take 9,000, add 6.5 plus inflation. You know, we could assume 3% inflation every year is a rough number. So take a 9.5 percentage gain every year, for 25 years to get them to age 65. I don't know what that comes to, but let's just say it would go from 9,000 to 40,000. I have no idea what the number is. So he knows that on the day he retires, the Dow is going to be at 40,000. He knows. Now, it may end up being at 37,000. It may end up being 43. We don't know that. We can't get it to the exact number. But you can get the neighborhood number. With if knowing that neighborhood number, would he rather it go to 40,000 today and then stall for 25 years? Or would he rather it stall where it is and then go to 40,000 in the last year? The answer is it's far better for him if the price increase is delayed, because he's going to be purchasing most of his stocks between now and when and 25 years from now. He's only bought a small percentage at age 40. He's got a lot more buying to do in the next 25 years. He wants to be doing that buying at low prices. So low prices, low stock prices are better than high stock prices. Now, you know, this comes up. I mean, this came up in something called, they used to call it the safe withdrawal rate paradox. And this used to drive the people trying to defend the old school safe withdrawal rate studies batty. And John Graney, who's the leader of the smear campaigns, he understands this very well. He addresses this in his study at his website, retireearlyhomepage.com. He has a study of safe withdrawal rates. And he says, John says, 4% withdrawal rate works at any valuation level. So he says, you know, if you need $1 million to retire and your portfolio's at $1 million, you can take out $40,000 every year, inflation adjusted, and that will last you 30 years. Very, very safe. If stocks perform as they always have in the past, that will work. But then people give this, and John himself is aware of this because it's addressed in his study. He said, well, what if in year 2009 you have $1 million and you retire. You need $40,000 to live on and you retire. And so under his study, that's 100% safe, living on $40,000. Now, what if somebody else who also has $1 million, also needs $40,000 to live on, in 2010, stock prices double? Hope I got this right. Stock prices double. Say the guy has $500,000 today. Stock prices double in a year. And now he has $1 million. And so now taking out $40,000 is 100% safe for him. Can the safe withdrawal rate be the same thing for both people? The second guy is taking out $40,000 a year. He's got $1 million. He's taking out $40,000 a year. The safe withdrawal rate study tells him that that's 100% safe. But the first guy, he retired with $1 million. He's taking out $40,000, but the stocks have just doubled. Shouldn't he be able to take out he's got $2 million. Shouldn't be able to take out twice as much as the second guy? Shouldn't he be able to take out $80,000? John says yes. John in his study calls it the periodic reset rule. He says if stocks double, you can just double your withdrawal rate. Go from $40,000 to $80,000. That's crazy. That can't be right. The flaw in this thinking is he has a periodic reset rule if stocks double. He says then you can take out 80, but he doesn't have a periodic reset rule if it works the other way. If the stock market falls by 50%, he doesn't say you have to reduce your withdrawal rate from 40 to 20. He just says you can take it at the day you retire, and then that stays forever. It can never go down, but it can go up. This is the logic of passive investing. It's insanity. The reality is that two things happen when prices either go up or down. When the stock price doubles, it's true that your portfolio doubles, which means, as John suggests, you have 2 million instead of 1 million. So if you were taking out 4%, you can take out not 40,000, but 80,000. That part's all right. But what he gets wrong is when the stock market doubles, that causes the safe withdrawal rate to fall in half. So the safe withdrawal rate goes from, if it was really 4% at the time the first person retired, it's now 2%. So you can take out 2% of 80,000, which is, lo and behold, 40,000. In other words, the amount you can withdraw safely doesn't change. That's stable. And the second guy, the guy who only had 500,000 and it suddenly went up to 1 million, he can only take out 2%. The withdrawal rate for him is not what the withdrawal rate was for the first guy. The withdrawal rate for the second guy is 2%, the safe withdrawal rate, and it's 2% on 1 million. Just as a year before, his withdrawal rate was 4% on 500,000. It comes to the same thing, 20,000. So the amount you can withdraw does not change just because the market price changes. This is the great flaw of the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, and it's the great flaw of all passive investing. Every time the price changes, two things happen. The amount in your portfolio changes, and the long-term return changes. Both things happen. Always. There are no exceptions. So, what this means is, gains in price and losses in price, in one sense, they're the same thing. Neither has any significance. Short-term gains have no significance, and long-term gains have no significance. The stock market is just going to reflect the economic realities in the long term. So whether prices happen to go up or happen to go down is immaterial, in one sense. However, it's not totally immaterial because the amount in your portfolio is not stable. You are buying over time. And since you're buying over time, you are better off with low prices. Because you're better to buy at low prices, because you're a buyer, not a seller. And the entire problem psychologically of understanding this is we don't think of ourselves as buyers of stocks. We think this is why the market doesn't work. This is why the stock market doesn't work like other markets. Middle class investors should be thinking of themselves as buyers. And they should always be thinking, I like stocks. We should all like stocks. But we should all be thinking, are stocks a good buy at this price? Maybe I should wait. Maybe I should time the market, as they say. If prices are bad, of course you want to time the market. If you don't time the market, you're not paying attention to price. That's the whole game, is paying attention to price. If you're not timing the market, you're giving up every strategic possibility. You're making it impossible for stock investing to work for you. This is why I can't stand passive investing. You give up every benefit that's available to you as an investor. It's the same thing as saying, I'm going to buy a car without looking at the price. No matter what the price is, I'm just going to tell the salesman when I walk in, I'm buying a car today. I don't care what the price is. If it's $10,000, I'm buying. If it's $100,000, you decide. No, makes no bit of difference to me because I read a book called Cars for the Long Run, and I'm a passive car buyer. I don't look at price. I don't time my car prices, my car buying. I'm buying today. You decide the price. I'm not worried about it. That's insane. But that's what we do with stock buying. We all need to understand that we are buyers of stocks. We think of ourselves as sellers. Now, why do we do that? The reason we think of ourselves as sellers is we all get these things called portfolio statements. And the portfolio statement basically tells us where we are in terms of planning for retirement. And we're all nervous about that. We're all anxious. And that makes us want the number on the portfolio statement to be as high as possible. So psychologically, in terms of the market transaction, we should want stock prices to be low. But psychologically, because of our fear of providing for our retirement,
We want stock prices to be high because the higher they are, the bigger that portfolio number is and the safer we feel about our retirement. So we're divided. Our loyalties are divided. So what we need, in my opinion, is reassurance on the retirement question. What we need from investing experts is we need them to teach us the realities and to emphasize those realities and to reiterate those realities over and over again so that it becomes second nature to us to understand that whenever prices go down, that's a good thing. And when prices go up, that's a bad thing. And we need reassurance on the portfolio number, you see. Take my ultimate example. I said the best thing for this fellow who's 40, I said the best thing would be if prices stayed at if the Dow stayed at 9,000 for 25 years, and then on the last year, when he turned 65, it went from 9,000 to 40,000, or whatever the number is. Well, you know, that's the best thing for him in terms of the numbers. But psychologically, if that happened, he'd be scared to death because he'd be looking at his retirement account as he got, you know, turned 50, 60, 65, and his retirement account wouldn't be growing, and he'd be freaking out. So what we all have to do is we all have to come to understand that the number on the portfolio statement is just a nominal number. It's not the real value. It's not the value of our holdings. The value of our holdings can be calculated, and we all should calculate it. What is the value of your stock holdings? The value is, which you have to start at a time of fair value. Start at a time when prices are where they are today, fair value. A P10 of 14 is fair value. We're today at 16. That's close enough. So start at 9,000. Dow today is a little over 9,000. Let's say 9,000. Maybe be P1014 if we were at 9,000. So we'll start with 9,000. What you have to do is take 9,000 plus 6.5 real, take 6.5 plus whatever the inflation rate is. Let's say on average it's 3.5 to make the numbers real easy. And just increase your portfolio amount by 10% every year. You got 100,000 this year. The next year, your internal value will be 110. The year after that, it's going to be 120 plus something. Next year, 130 plus something. That's how it works. And I think everyone should be doing that exercise. Everyone should be calculating the real internal value of their stock portfolio and ignoring the number on the portfolio statement, which jumps up and down in all kinds of crazy ways, which are meaningless in the long term. The beauty of this is, if you were living in the 1990s, when prices were going up 30% a year, you would have been taking 10% as real. This is after inflation. And ignoring the rest. So you wouldn't have gotten all hyped up thinking, oh, I can spend more on cars and vacations and houses, because you would have known that money wasn't real. It was just cotton candy. It was nothingness. It was air. And then when prices crashed, there wouldn't have been any crash for you. All that prices did in September 2008 was fall back to fair value. If you had been keeping fair value numbers all along, all that would have happened is there'd be a line on a chart where you would have a line on your chart saying, this is the value of my portfolio, the true internal value. And then, you know, you could do a line for the nominal value, and that would have gone way above the internal value. And then in September 2008, the line for nominal value just came back down to the real internal value. So there would have been no shock for you, no surprise for you, because you knew what was going on. You knew the ABCs of stock investing. This is the ABCs. This is how stock investing works. Now, don't take my word for it. I'm just some guy who posts on the internet, for God's sake. Check it out. Read Shiller. Read Rob Arnott. Read Cliff Asness. Read John Walter Russell. You know, read Andrew Smithers. Check it out. Look at the historical data. But you know, I've checked it out, and I think this is how it works. I believe this strongly. I've pretty much devoted my life to it for 7 years now, because it checks out, at least according to me. You know, if it doesn't check out, I've been too dumb to figure out why not. So the point here is, we need a psychological change. We need to stop rooting for high prices and start rooting for low prices. We need to think of ourselves not as part of the stock selling industry, but to think of ourselves, you know, as part of the stock buying public. We are stock buyers. We don't want high prices. So when people start, you know, touting stocks for the long run, buying all, timing doesn't work, that pushes prices up. That causes people to buy more stocks, which causes bull markets, and we don't want that. That's against our self-interest. We should be lobbying for the stock selling industry to tell the straight story. We should be lobbying to stop all this nonsense that destroys middle-class investors, destroys our retirement accounts, and destroys the U.S. economy, ultimately. Now, the last point I wanted to address is this question of, how about when you get to, is there ever a time when you become a stock seller? You know, Bernstein is right that when you get to retirement, it does change. Because then, it certainly changes. Put it this way. It changes if you have to withdraw from the account. Some people, when they turn 65, they start, they're in the what's called the accumulation stage from, say, 25 to 65. That means their portfolio is growing. They're buying stocks. They're earning money, and part of their earnings goes to buy stocks. They're in the accumulation stage. And at 65, that changes, and they start selling stocks. And they live off the earnings from selling. If that is true for you, then it's true that when you become an actual seller, you want high prices, of course. You sell something, you want a high price. But a lot of us, even that's not true. A lot of us, when we turn 65, there's a couple reasons why. One, a lot of us want to leave money to our children or charities. And if you're going to leave money to children, you're not necessarily going to sell all your stocks before you die. Maybe you're not going to sell any. A lot of us would like to have slack built in to our retirement plans. So what a lot of us do is, a very common thing among retirees and a sensible thing is to say, you know, live off the dividends. Don't sell the stocks at all. Live off the dividends. That way you never have to sell. Well, if you never sell, you never get to this point where you want high prices. Or if you want to leave it all to your kids, you don't want high prices. In other words, the same penalty for high prices that applies for you up until age 65 applies to your children after 65. If you want to pass more wealth along to them, you want prices to stay low even after you turn 65. So Bernstein's point is well taken. He is right. But there are caveats to that. It's not strictly true. It's true in some cases and not in others. So in general, we have to do a couple things. We all have to start to realize that low prices are better than high prices for most investors. We should not be rooting for high prices. And there's all sorts of things that go with that. If you're not rooting for high prices, you're certainly not rooting for bull markets when prices go through the roof. Bull markets are the worst thing that could ever happen to a middle-class investor. Bull markets are a horror story. So you don't want to be rooting for high prices. You need to know the internal value, though. If you don't root for high prices, you need to know the internal value in order to have reassurance that your retirement plan is moving ahead. The only way you can understand that is to have a number on a piece of paper you can look at and say, I'm better off today than I was yesterday. And you can do that by adding 6.5 real, because that's not a bull market. That's real. When the market goes up 6.5 real, that's real, the real stuff. That's economic growth. So that you should count in your private bookkeeping every year, plus inflation, 6.5 plus inflation. So you need to keep internal books so that you'll have reassurance that your retirement plan is moving ahead, and so that you won't freak out and become a passive investor and start rooting for greater price increases than that, than are justified. And some of us should be rooting for higher prices at retirement, but only those that are pulling out stocks. Those that are not pulling out should continue to root for low prices. And of course, the reality is the world is not going to behave in this, according to these crazy scenarios where there's, you know, no growth for stock prices stay stable for 20 years. And then, you know, there's huge growth in the last year before you retire. That's not going to happen in the real world. In the real world, it's going to be a mix. There's going to be years when the growth is far more than what's appropriate. And there are going to be years when the growth is far less than what's appropriate. And so what's really going to happen is you want to keep those internal numbers so that you keep your head, so that you don't get emotional about them. And the last caveat is you don't really always want to go, you generally want to root for lower prices. Lower stock prices are better than higher stock prices, as a general rule. But there's a time when prices are too low. And I would say if fair value P/10 is 14 or 15. If you go below 12, certainly if you go below 10, I think an argument can be made prices are too low. If we were to fall to 10 over the next couple of years, and I think there's a good chance we will, I will be very nervous. And the reason is, it's all fine and good to say we're better off as investors to have low stock prices. That's true. The logic holds. But we have to understand this. Not everybody else out there understands that low stock prices are good. And if prices get too low, when prices get low, because, see, passive investing is a mindset. It's a psychological mindset. People who believe in passive investing believe that high prices are good. What passive investors essentially believe is that prices come from a random number generator in the sky. So what they believe is if prices go up 30%, you get to keep that, and then the return next year is probably going to be 6.5 again. In other words, there's no effect. The 30% just doesn't matter. They just sort of act like it doesn't matter. They look at the positive side of the equation, and then ignore the negative side. All price increases have a positive and a negative, and all price drops have a positive and a negative. If prices get too low, the passive investors are going to become depressed. And if the passive investors become depressed, they're going to stop spending even more than they already have. And that's going to hurt the economy. And if the economy takes a bigger hit than it's already taken, we could go into a depression. And if we go into a depression, none of this works. That, you know, the U.S. economy will no longer generate 6.5 real if there is no more U.S. economy. If there's political unrest, if there's a world war, all these sorts of things. So what we really want, in general, it's true that low stock prices are better than high stock prices. But I think the best of all worlds is moderate prices at all times. That's really the ideal. And the way to get moderate prices is to avoid extremes, to avoid emotional extremes. All overvaluation is the product of emotion. All undervaluation is the product of emotion. The best investing model is an investing model that diminishes the emotional influence, the influence of emotion on investing decisions. And that's the model that describes stock investing accurately, so that when people follow the model, they gain confidence in it over time, rather than losing confidence in it over time. Passive investing, investors lose confidence over time because it doesn't describe reality. It describes bull markets. As long as the bull market lasts, passive investing is aces. Bull markets always end in savage bear markets, and savage bear markets make people lose confidence in passive investing. So passive investing never works long term. So I think it's true that in general, we should be rooting for low stock prices, but we shouldn't become extremist about it. The reality is, if all of us who are informed root for low stock prices, prices aren't going to go that low, because there always are going to be passive investors in the world. I think of it like in the Bible, you know, Jesus said, the poor will be with us always. Passive / emotional investors will be with us always. There's always going to be passive investors. There's always going to be emotional investors. What we need is to have a larger number of rational investors to counter the human weakness to passive investing, the human weakness to emotional investing. That's what I believe. I believe the desire to believe that high stock prices come without a cost is just a get-rich-quick impulse that we're all born with. We're all weak. It's like the desire to eat 6 pieces of chocolate cake. And what we need in the stock selling industry is what we already have in the medical industry. In the medical industry, doctors advise us not to eat 6 pieces of cake. That doesn't mean we don't eat any cake at all. It just means we try to limit the extremes. That's what we need in the stock industry. We need advice that doesn't encourage us to become more emotional, which is what all these marketing slogans do, buy and hold and timing doesn't work and all this sort of thing. We want marketing slogans that encourage us to be more rational, less emotional. And I think the phrase, the statement, low stock prices are better than high stock prices, I hope does that. It encourages us to move in the opposite direction of the direction in which the passive / emotional approach pushes us. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.